Hello, my friends. I'm, as always, happy to be here. As always, happy to see so many people from all over the world who are interested in this, who are interested in something other than the usual. I wonder sometimes, I'm going to read a couple of emails in a minute here, and as I did last time, and as I suppose I'll be doing until I stop doing it, I'll be reading emails during our meetings here and speaking about the content, because it is truly my experience that although when we are fixed on the idea that we are trapped and alone and isolated in these lives and these bodies, I know that it can seem, and not without some basis, it can seem that the internal struggle and the internal suffering and misery and efforts to get free, and the misery and torment that accompanies those efforts are very, very much mine and very specific and unique to my own spiritual life and my own spiritual aspirations and so forth. And the reason I know that's true is because I have that experience for myself. I know that during the period of time when I was locked in a mad spiritual melodrama, trying desperately to figure my way out, to pray my way out, to practice my way out, to meditate my way out, to whatever my way out, that if anyone has suggested to me that the deep, rich specialness of my suffering was actually quite common and one of a very few species of that torture, that I would have been offended, because of course how could I not know how special and unique I am as an individual, and how special and unique therefore my suffering must be, and my confusion and torment must be. So I don't say that as in a dismissive way, or a way that comes from a place of having no personal experience with it, but I say that from having seen in retrospect myself how ordinary my dark night of the soul turned out to be. How ordinary. And that's one of the reasons that I like to read these letters, is because it's useful to see that these reactions and interpretations and arisings that cluster around the appearance of self-inquiry in a mind are actually not so unusual after all. And then, of course, there's the other possibility that I have heard of, not from my own experience, but from the experience of some of the people who have been with me in this adventure for some time, and that is that for some, of course, the whole business of spiritual melodrama and torture and torment and suffering and aspiring and failing and all of that is incomprehensible. For some, the very first arising of the inclination to look inward, to find what's real rather than all the other things that have interested me, that the very first arising of this inclination is the end of it. It's too simple. It's simple and easy. And oh yeah, right, of course. But I think that's the exception to the rule. the rule is for those of us who are involved and in love with spiritual ideas, the rule is that we will suffer mightily as our last opportunity to enjoy that particular aspect of human life. And that as we suffer, it turns out that the things that we suffer about and the things that we find ourselves to be confused and seek clarity about are pretty much the same for all of us. And that's the reason I like to read these emails. Number one, to reveal that aspect of this adventure, the aspect in which all of the drama and juice and so forth are unnecessary and beside the point. They're okay. They don't hurt you, but they're beside the point. And the other is because just for the sheer economy of the use of time, since I receive hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails, all of which pretty much fall into just a couple of issues, it's useful to me to be able to speak about these things publicly by responding publicly to those who have written me from the certainty of the private nature of their misery. And I don't identify people when I read these emails, but I think you can identify yourself, whether you are the one that wrote the email or you are the one who is caught up in the same trick bag. You can identify yourself and you can recognize these things as things that afflict you. And perhaps if I have anything whatsoever useful to say to the issues that I speak to in these emails, perhaps they'll be useful to you as well. So I'm going to read a couple and then I'll talk some more. I think one of the things that makes it difficult for us to see through the allure of the spiritual melodrama is that, you know, we as human beings have been trying this forever and ever. And we have been doing the same things over and over again, expecting, of course, different results. And we kind of get stuck in this one viewpoint of things, which is, for some, the idea that reality is of this nature rather than that nature, that reality is best spoken of in this way rather than that way, when the fact of the matter is that the only point to, I suppose there are those personalities who will find value and usefulness in gathering together to speak about the philosophical and metaphysical aspects of spiritual aspiration, and that's fine. But the only real usefulness in the whole spiritual realm is, and even in considering the spiritual realm, is practical. The thing that we miss so much is that there's no point to any of this unless it has a good end. There's no point to meditation, there's no point to therapy, there's no point to religious observance, there's no point to any of it unless it has a good end. We come to it because we are assured that these practices or these understandings or these insights or these religious observances will provide us with clarity and relief and salvation and redemption. We really don't enter into them for the purpose of gaining understanding. We seek understanding in order to effect the practical goal of freeing us from misery and suffering. We don't seek spiritual states, samadhis and so forth, in order to, in the first place, in order to enjoy the pleasure that attends these spiritual samadhis and states. We seek them because we are assured that in some way they will serve to free us from this nightmare of misery and suffering that our life has been up until now. We don't even go to the psychotherapist in order that we can enjoy the pleasure of conversation with someone who is as deeply interested in our minds as we are, although that's a bonus. We go to the psychotherapist because we are assured that by entering into that practice that we will be freed of misery and suffering, the nightmare of misery and suffering, fearfulness and anxiety. The point of this is that always our intent and the motive that drives us is practical in nature. It's pragmatic in nature. This is overlooked because everything seems so spiritual. So let me read you a couple emails here that I've received. Actually, this is not an email. It's a posting to a forum that is on our website called Conversations, and which I have to say has been woefully neglected just because I don't have the time I'd like to have to devote to this thing. This posting recently appeared there, and I really want to speak to it a little bit. It says this: I recently listened to a podcast of yours in which you keep saying, quote, "You are not your life," unquote. Many things you say seem reasonable to me, but this does not. I keep hearing Ramana saying, is your life apart from the self? It's a shame there's not more activity on this forum, as I am intensely interested in anything about Ramana Maharshi and have been for many years. And here's another email. This is an email that I received along the same lines. It says this: I encountered some satsang videos of you on YouTube the other day. What you are saying is very impressive, and I think by trying to convey your truth, you certainly create openings in the energy field of many people. At least this is the case with me. So thank you very much. But seriously, I am stuck with the question. While talking about your efforts to reach other people to wake up, I wonder who you are referring to. Who is to be awakened? Which you are you addressing in me? The eye of my ego? Does my personal eye have to see what is really true? What is the truth? What is reality? What is to be seen or experienced? Or is it the one eye, my oneness, that has to be shaken up to awake and see what's really going on, so it can watch the egoic eye causing the disturbance and trying to divert my consciousness into useless thinking? This I don't get out of my thoughts, because if it were to be the latter I, then this is the I that already knows what really is, isn't it? You see, what these two emails have in common is a confusion about the way I speak. The one talks about me saying you are not your life, and the other talks about me speaking to you without distinguishing which you I'm speaking to. So both of them have to do with the way I speak, and I have to tell you that I don't pay much attention whatsoever to the way I speak. It is very clear to me, beyond all possibility of confusion, that I can find no way whatsoever at any time to speak to you and to form sentences and paragraphs and so forth that are true to reality, except that everything is true to reality. There's no way that I can form and contort my speech and my delivery in such a way that there will be a correctness to the way I speak, that is consistent with all of the metaphysical and philosophical speculation about the nature of reality. I can't do that, so I don't even try. I just speak to you naturally, just ordinary speech, so that when I say you, I'm talking to you, and you know who you are, you know what you are. I'm not speaking to ego, and I'm not speaking to the true self, I'm speaking to you, this reality of presence that hears my words, this reality of presence that is the source and the destination of all things whatsoever, thoughts, ideas, understandings, confusion, and everything. I'm speaking to you, and it's on you to know what you are. I can't tell you what you are. It's of no use for me to tell you that there are two yous, a little you and a big you, one of which has to go and the other of which has to be woken up. That doesn't help you at all. That's just an interpretation of the reality that all are constantly aware of. That's just an interpretation of the reality that is endlessly giving rise to its own interpretations and its own versions of narrative about itself. That's what this world is. That's what the whole universe is the arising of reality's attempt to say something about itself, to see itself, to explore the infinite range of expression just that. So, how could I do better than that? It falls short. How could I do better than that? So I don't try. I just speak to you. I tell you, wherever you are, in whatever form you're appearing, that if you believe, if it feels to you that you are subject to fear and suffering, to misery and anxiety, if that's what it feels like to you, then I suggest to you that you, along with everything else you're doing, take a moment from time to time to check in, to look at yourself, to get the direct, immediate, uninterpreted taste of yourself, which is always present. And I suggest to you that if you will do that over time, without regard to what that is, without regard to what you are, without regard to what it all means, without regard to whether all is one or all is manifold, without regard to any of that, if you will do that, just get the direct, uninterpreted taste of yourself briefly, whenever you can, whenever it occurs to you, I tell you that those underlying feelings of fearfulness and anxiety, of misery and suffering, of being at stake in your life will vanish over time, some quicker than others, some with more drama than others, but they will go over time. And that's all that I have to say. So, to whom am I speaking? I don't think anybody needs to wake up. I'm speaking to you. If this is your experience, this is the way out. There is no other way. There is nothing else but reality that can reveal to you the absolute, unconditional, eternal freedom that you are. It's reality. If it's reality, then you must see it for yourself. And then whatever interpretations arise in you as to what you see, like there is not two, or all is one, or all is love, or all is whatever, are perfectly fine, although limited, just as everything that's been said about you is perfectly fine, although limited. But coming then from the realization, small r, the realization that you are not your life alone. Your life, on the other hand, is you. There is absolutely nothing about your life that doesn't have as its essential substance you. Your life is you. You are not your life. You are the space in which your life comes and goes. You are the light in which your life sees all, sees itself, sees the world that is created, sees everything, hears everything. So you are not your life. Your life certainly is you. Everything, there is nothing anywhere to be found that is not you. And you know who I'm talking to. You may think you don't, you may deny that you do, but I tell you, you know who I'm talking to when I say that. So, that being the case, and that being my experience, I really don't try to make my speech or my expressions conform to any canonical correctness that bows to the primacy of non-dualistic expression over dualistic expression. If there is not two, if all is one, then separation and individual existence, how could that be unwelcome here? Separation and individual existence is a gift. It is an amazing and magnificent gift. It's not the problem. Which is why I say to you that your life is not the problem. Which is why I say to you that you are not your life, not alone. I'll add that little qualification in order to add that qualification. But that's why I say to you, you are not your life. You are not. You are not subject to the confusion and the heartache and the loss, the fearfulness and the anxiety. You are not subject to that. You're the source of it all. But your life is you. It's all you. There's nothing anywhere to be found that's not you. And there's another kind of category of emails I get, and I just happened to, this isn't, you know, I don't go through these things and try to find the best example. I just try to find a example. And this is, this may not be the best, but nevertheless. Dear John, I want to thank you again for your worldwide satsang. This opportunity for so many like-minded people so far from each other to be together is priceless. Recently, this search for truth seems to be no more than another form of entertainment. Some holy quest that is more noble than other things just because I want to know what I am, who this God is that everyone says fills the universe and beyond. I feel that this is just all bull that has been pounded into my consciousness since forever. I even sometimes feel that I am just insane, searching for something that will fix me, this life, give me permanent pleasure, heal all suffering, and infuse me with knowing. Just more crap loaded into my skull by all the teachings, books, talks, everything. And yet, through all of this, I know that there is something that is always here, some sense of peace and well-being, something that, well, just is. I would say that knowing that is the dropping of all those concepts, but I see that that is just more conceptual crap, too. Well, yeah, everything is, really, everything. I mean, I have to say that even the impetus for the inquiry itself is conceptual crap, because ipso facto, the impetus for the inquiry itself is the belief that you're trapped in your life and filled with misery and suffering and fearfulness and anxiety, and that simply isn't true. So that too is conceptual crap, the whole business of you being trapped in your life and all of that. That's just not true. It's also true that often, in fact, in almost every realm, in almost every arena, what masquerades as the search for truth is entertainment. I shouldn't say masquerades, because that implies some ill intent. I don't mean that. But the whole manifestation that has arisen around the idea of searching for truth or searching for God or searching for reality or whatever, that whole thing is certainly entertaining, the gathering together in meetings and, you know, and meditating and being quiet and being silent and getting the emotional and spiritual experiences of uplifting and freedom and all of that. That certainly is all entertainment, and damn good entertainment, I might add. A lot better than a lot of the other things that we hook into to pass the time in these lives. Not as good as some, a lot better than others. But so what? The mistake we make is thinking that anything that we're doing in that realm has anything whatsoever to do with reality. That's the mistake. It's not that the search for truth is some form of entertainment, some holy quest that is more noble than others, just because I want to know what I am and so forth. And that's the, you know, it's not more noble than others. Everybody, all the time, every second of their life, which with every breath, is seeking the same thing. It's seeking the truth. It's seeking an end to misery. Everybody wants to be finished with misery. Whether they try to do so in a spiritual context, whether they try to do so in the context of taking drugs or sex or rock and roll or religious experience or whatever, everybody's trying to get rid of misery. Everybody wants to be happy. Everybody. And it is true that we have a tendency to say that spiritual matters are better than mundane matters because spiritual matters are more noble. They pertain to more noble things. The rest of it's worldly. This is special. And it's really true that that's not true. It really isn't. Whatever we're doing, whatever we are doing in these lives, that other than seeking the direct, uninterpreted, unmediated, immediate taste of me, of what I am, what's always here, doesn't require understanding, doesn't require even being entertained. Although it is amazingly entertaining. Doesn't require that you see it as noble. Doesn't require that you see it as self-sacrificing. Just requires that you do it. All the rest is entertainment. Entertainment is good. Entertainment is wonderful. We look at the sky. We are entertained by the beauty, the magnificence of the clear blue sky or the stars, or the mountains, or each other, or art, or music, or drugs, or any of it. Entertainment's fine, beside the point. And the problem arises when we don't don't make that, when we find that we cannot make that distinction between reality and reality's radius, between reality and reality's playground. The, what's available to us has nothing to do with choosing one thing over another. This is better than that. This rock and roll is better than church, or church is better than rock and roll. The possibility open to us is to be finished with all of that, to let all of that go on as it will, and just add this one element. Whenever it occurs to us, stop just for a second and get the direct, uninterpreted, unmediated taste of what you are, of what it is to be, just to be. What's that feel like? Just to be. And that's not in order to do anything. It's not in order to become that, or stay with that, or be in compliance or in harmony with that, or to do anything at all with that, but just to rid yourself of the idea that you are limited to this life, and that you are at stake in this life, and that you are suffering and miserable in this life. And one other thing that I hear a lot from people, although I don't have an email to refer to here, and that is the experience that comes to many, and maybe, I don't know, not everybody, nothing comes to everybody, but the experience that comes to many and that I'm familiar with, wherein it seems like all the that as the inquiry proceeds, there comes a point when all of the interest in life fades. Comes a point when it seems like, wow, life is just not, it's just not interesting. It's not, I don't have the drive I used to have. I don't have the energy to go out and do things, and make things happen, and take care of myself. And am I going to end up homeless on the street? Am I going to end up in an alley somewhere begging for my food, or just wasting away? You know what I mean. The lotus eaters, the ones who especially in this country, in the United States, of course, we have a long, deep vein of work ethic. So such a thought here in the United States, maybe more than anywhere else in the world, is crippling and really scary. The idea that I might not care anymore. I might not be able to take care of my family. I might not be able to go to work. All I can say is that if it is to be, that you are to become disinterested and withdrawn and uninvolved in life and human activity and so forth, if that is to be, it will be, whether you enter the inquiry or fail to enter the inquiry. If it is to be that you are to be a stockbroker and a go-getter and a master of the universe, that too will be, whether you enter the inquiry or do not enter the inquiry. You see, whatever it is that's arising as this personality, as this person, is already arising within the spaciousness that you are and within the absolute uninvolvement, lack of involvement that you have already in how this life unfolds and how it plays out. All of the internal experience of the critical need to do something about the life, the critical need to make sure that things are happening the way they should be happening, the critical need to make sure that I'm thinking the right thoughts and not the wrong thoughts, that I am being responsible and not irresponsible. All these things, too, are already arising in this personality, in this manifestation, that itself already just comes and goes within this open spaciousness that you are, within you, who are absolutely unconcerned about doing anything about how the life unfolds. Already the life lives itself. It won't be any different if you rid it of this undercurrent of fearfulness and anxiety, except that this undercurrent of fearfulness and anxiety will no longer be here. And in absence of that, the true change in the life occurs, which is a change that takes away from life this endless need to do for me at the expense of anything else, to serve me, this life, this personality, at the expense of all things, to put me, this life, this personality, above every other in the world. And it's this energy, and it's this characteristic of the life that is plagued by fearfulness and anxiety, it is this that is eradicated in the inquiry, in the investigation, in the seeing of yourself. Because everything is in the seeing. All the work is done by the seeing. There's no need for you to understand or get rid of your understanding of anything. There's no need for you to change or to keep from changing any habitual pattern of behavior that you're aware of. There's no need for you to do anything about your wrong ideas or your wrong outlook on life or your confusion or your anger or your self-service or your self-hatred even. All of that will be taken care of. All that's needed is for you to rid yourself of this underlying unseen, unseeable, unbelievable conviction that you are this life alone. And the only thing that will do that is continuous exposure over a period of time to the light of reality. And nothing else will do that, and nothing else needs to be done but that. And time will tell. I mean, I kind of think it would be not so bad if I became a lotus eater. That has not been the case for me, and I don't know if offhand of anybody for whom it has been the case. But who knows? It might be you. You might be the first. But for me, actually, quite the contrary. This life is unbelievably engaged in the world, really, without any interference or involvement on my part. It's unbelievably engaged in the world after, oh, I don't know, what was it, 18 and a half years of retreat and isolation. Now, this life is engaged. It has nothing to do with me. I'm not helped nor hurt by the activity of this life. Nor are you. Nor is anyone. So, all of the things that people talk about and all of the things that people have as problems, to me, all of them, I mean, and I really mean this, every one of them, pretty much, every one of them is beside the point. Not wrong, not bad, just beside the point of my work, which is to bring to you this possibility of looking at yourself. seeing yourself. Just that. And see what happens. If you begin, I can also pretty much guarantee you that if you begin this inquiry, if you begin this practice of looking at the reality of what you are, if you begin, I can pretty much guarantee you that the time will come when you will be able to do nothing about it anyway, that the inquiry will continue on its own, and that quite unexpectedly, and which you would not think to be the case, you will come to see that actually the whole life has been engaged in the inquiry at all times, with every breath, engaged in the looking to see what I am. Looking perhaps in the wrong direction, but always engaged in that. That is at the heart of everything we do. And sometimes we do it by trying to make ourselves what we think we ought to be, or to make ourselves what we would like to be, or to understand ourselves, but always in the service of this underlying force of life that is the desire to see yourself. And as you begin to turn your attention inward in the only direction in which you can find yourself, since that works, you will find that over time that that happens on its own. And you will find, finally, over time, that the great paradox will reveal itself to you, which is that since the life is not a problem, the eradication of the belief that I am trapped in the life does not create a distancing from the life, but quite to the contrary, a new intimacy with this wonderful manifestation that is personality and person and me and you. So expect me to be incorrect when I speak to you. Expect me to be not in compliance with the way that these matters should be spoken about, because I don't have any interest in the way they should be spoken about. I have interest only in you. I have interest only in you, which is me. I have interest only in the possibility of seeing an end in all of humanity to this madness of misery and suffering based on a lie. Okay. There's no hurry, but if you want to speak with me about any of this or about anything else, let Carla know and we'll talk together. Thank you for this.
We have Travis calling from San Francisco.
Hi, Travis.
Hi, John. I just wanted to give a report and a kind of a check-in. But first, I just want to say hallelujah, and I love you and Carla for what you're doing and for all your work. And it's always wonderful to get to talk to you.
Likewise.
So I don't want to take up too much time, but I had kind of three points that I wanted to check in with you about just to, you know, sound off, make sure I'm on the right page. So these are in my practice of doing this self-inquiry as you pass on from Ramana Maharshi. Things come up, you know, ideas, realizations, whatever you want to call them, but I don't know if you want to call them settlings of what's going on in my life, but these things just come up, and I just wanted to bounce three of them off you if I can.
Sure.
Well, the first thing that came to me, I do a morning sort of meditation practice where I sit down and take some dedicated time to do the inquiry, but I also do it throughout the day, and I have found, you know, that over time I don't have a choice in that matter anymore. As you say, it just sort of takes over and does itself. But I don't know, about a month or two ago, it occurred to me that I was looking always for this feeling of reality within myself and thinking that somehow it was being carried around from place to place in this body mind, and that that's the only place where it existed, like it was this object I was looking for that I carried around with me. And I realized that that is not the case, that the reason why this body mind can feel it at all is because this awareness is because it already is anywhere that I can go, and it is already in any condition that I can find myself, that there's nothing special about a locale or a situation, that just as it is here now, if I walk across the room, it won't be across the room because I went there. It will be there because it's already there.
That's actually very perfect. Yes, that's exactly the case. And this is just a, you know, as time goes on and as you are more and more exposed to this, to the light of this reality, these old confusions will just naturally begin to clear up, as this one has. I'm happy to hear that. Yes, you are everywhere. And it has nothing to do with the position of the body or where it is.
Yeah, it's interesting. These we all come up with our own words for them. And I just sort of been referring to them as sort of inversions, these kind of reversals of the way I thought things were before as the practice continues. And the other one was that I was in my morning practice, and when I'm in my morning practice and looking for myself, the sounds of the building, my neighbors, my wife sometimes when she snores because I meditate in the same room while she's asleep in the morning, the birds outside, the traffic, all of that stuff is just fine. It really isn't a problem, and it's never been a disturbance to looking at what I am. But I found myself trying to get my thoughts to stop. Like, I'm here, I'm doing this, and my thoughts would come up, and I'd say, okay, wait, now that has to quiet down, and then I can get them quiet down, and then I go back to the inquiry, and I realized the other day, wait a minute, what's the difference between a thought going through my head and a siren going by on the street? If the siren's going by on the street and it's not changing me from being what I am, why is the thought changing it? And I realized that they don't, that the thoughts are going to come up, and that's just fine, and nothing to be done about them. They're just like the chirping of the birds outside, and pleasant and all that sometimes, and sometimes bothersome, but they don't stop the inquiry.
Excellent, yes, and pleasant and bothersome also are thoughts, and it's no need to distinguish between them, and nor is there any need to do away with that. Yes, you're absolutely right. The thoughts are just like the birds chirping outside. You know, I sometimes talk to people, and there is a meditation practice that the Buddhists use that can be very useful, and I'm going to speak about it just briefly here using you as the platform, Travis. But the only meditation practice that I have found in my own experience to be of use is this mindfulness meditation practice, which is very simple, and it has no purpose to it, which is why it's as useful as it is. It really has no purpose to it other than mindfulness, which is a difficult thing to define anyway. And it's very much along the lines of what you're discovering, and you may even know of this, but it consists in just watching your breath. Actually, it consists in counting your breath. It consists in sitting quietly and with your eyes open or closed, it doesn't matter, and getting your attention focused on the sensation of your breath as it passes across the flesh of your nostrils as it goes in and out of your body. And then, once you've got the sense of that, which is to say that you're actually focusing on the sensation rather than the naming of the sensation or the story about the sensation that I just told. Just that sensation. It's cool and when it's coming in, and it's warm when it's going out. But even prior to recognizing it as cool and warm, when you're focusing directly on that sensation. Then you start counting your breaths. You count up to 10. You count with each out-breath or with each in-breath. It really doesn't matter. One. And then as you count, you will find that your attention is drawn away to such things as the birds chirping in the back, in the outside, or your spouse snoring or whatever else, or thoughts arising and so forth. And the instruction is that when that happens, and you, after you realize what has happened, which could take who knows how long, when you realize what's happening, you just say to yourself, no matter what it is, whether it's a what's commonly thought of as a thought or a physical sensation like an itch or a stiffness or something, or the birds outside, whatever it is that has called you away from your breath, just say to yourself silently, internally, thinking, and start over at one. Now, the long-term effect of this practice, and you don't have to do it for long, 15 minutes or so is plenty. The long-term effect of this particular practice, as I say, it has no purpose, and it really doesn't, except to sweeten and kind of relax the mental energy, so that as you can see, as you have, Travis, that there is no difference whatsoever between thinking and the birds chirping, that neither of them helps you, neither of them hurts you, neither of them has any effect on you whatsoever. They are phenomena that come and go within you, and they're just fine. Some of them are pleasant, some of them are unpleasant. They're just fine. And so that the usefulness of this meditation practice, this mindfulness meditation of counting breath, is just to get the mind accustomed to its own spaciousness and its own stationariness compared with these objects of thought that move within it. And that, as you have seen, is quite a valuable insight in the inquiry, because you don't need to excoriate yourself because you have lost track of what you're looking at when you're trying to look at what reality is. You don't need to figure out what to do about it. You just go back to what you were doing. And so anyway, I just wanted to say that I eventually get around to saying that most places I talk, and it is a practice that's useful and can be helpful and brings the same insight that you report here, Travis.
Thanks, John. I do appreciate that, and yeah, I've heard some versions of the mindfulness meditation before from Zen and whatnot, and I like the simple ways that you put it. But the last thing I just kind of wanted to say or bring up, the last point to check in about, was, so there I was, as I'm now always doing, checking in, what does it feel like to be? And it occurred to me that, and I'm trying to struggle with a way to point this, to put this right, because it's kind of a paradox, like you said before, that the action of looking for me is me. I don't know of another way to put that, but that it's kind of a trick that we attempt to do this awareness and attempt to get this feeling and direct ourselves towards this feeling, and that is nothing other than what we're naturally doing, just as you just said a few minutes ago, and that in point of fact what we're trying to do, or my experience is what I'm trying to do in this practice, is force myself to be what I already am. Well, since I already am, then I'm being that, and there you have it. And I can't ever not be that. Being is being aware. There's no separation between awareness and being. The two are synonymous. So that in this practice of consciously being, what I'm doing is consciously being what I'm already being. And but what made me smile when this sort of thing sunk into me was that I had always in spiritual journey been searching for some, as we always do, like you said, some big explosion, some big settlement, some big end, some big conclusion. But what I actually did is I just kind of went, oh, like, yeah, no big deal. And I'm very grateful to you for that.
Well, that makes my heart laugh. That's exactly right. No big deal. It's exactly as you say, Travis. It is always, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that's interesting to me is that I really have no interest at all in encouraging people to become where they already are. And I know how compelling that idea is to us, that we need to become what we are, that we're doing the inquiry in order that we can become this beingness. And of course, as you see, that is absolutely, it's almost clinically insane. And the truth is that even when we are trying to see what we are trying to see what we are already always seeing. Always. And it is that, it is the paradoxical nature of all of that that makes it so damnably difficult to speak about or to offer to people or to encourage people with, which is why it was such a cause for rejoicing when I could see that Ramana has nothing to do with any of that. It doesn't have anything to do with becoming anything, being anything, understanding anything, getting anything, getting rid of anything or anything. It just has to do with this, looking at yourself, looking, trying with all your heart to get the taste of yourself, which I know, as I say, is always already here. But that doesn't matter. It is the, when the effort is turned in the right direction, it always bears fruit. No matter what its initial intent or its initial motive or its initial idea was, and that's why I don't care too much about how I say things, as long as what I am always saying is look at yourself. That's all. Just look at yourself. See. That's all it takes. And that's, you're the proof of the pudding, Travis. So thank you so much for these reports and so forth.
Thank you, John. I love this venue, but I wish someday I'll see you in person so you can see me smiling at you and nodding my head. And thank you for listening to my report and for this time. And much love and blessings to you and Carla for the rest of this year. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Is there anybody else, Carla?
Now we have Rupam calling from Western Australia.
Rupam, it's you again. How nice to see you.
Oh, thank you, John. Thank you for allowing me this, allowing all of us this opportunity. It's so precious. And it sort of doesn't matter what I say. I just wanted this moment just to feel how we all are here in it together, and not we all, just it is here and it's loving it so much.
Yes, yes, yes. So you don't have a problem, Rupam?
No. No problem, John. Just to report that life appears to be so serving this continuing, what word do you use, this continuing enjoying with each other. And even like what I wrote to you about suddenly wanting to know you, and then I hear on the radio talking about a mentor, and then I understand, oh yes, a mentor, someone confirming it. Oh, words. Just the joy of it together. Thank you, John. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you, Rupam. Is there anybody else?
Tal is calling from Jerusalem, Israel.
Hi, Tal.
Hi, John. I wanted to ask you a question. I wanted to ask if there are different qualities of looking into yourself, because I feel there are in my investigation. Sometimes I have a lot of energy, and then I can see myself clearly. I mean, I can see that I'm not the body, and I'm in fact isolated from the body. But sometimes it happens that I can't see anything. I feel like I don't have the energy to look at myself and to see. I mean, I think I have expectations before the investigations. I always have these expectations, and when I don't have the energy, my mind comes into like a terror. I mean, and it's a conflict in the mind, and I can't get out of it until I get what I want, which is to see myself clearly. That's my question.
Well, let me ask you something, Tal. Are you here now? I don't mean here like here in Ojai, obviously not. But are you here? Are you certain of your own existence now, right now?
Yes.
And can you look and see what it feels like to be certain of your own existence?
Yes, it's the pure feeling of being I am.
That's you. That is the target of your investigation. There is nothing more to it than that. And I understand very, very clearly, and with personal experience, that the vicissitudes, the changefulness of the mental states can interfere and call your attention away from that and so forth. And I understand from personal experience that there is an expectation, that there are many expectations, but there certainly is an expectation that I am engaging in whatever it is I am engaging with in order to bring some clarity and transformation of the mind, the monkey mind, which is endlessly holding on to things and chewing on things and getting it all turned inside out of itself and so forth. I understand that too. But I tell you this, Tal, none of that has to be done away with. None of the expectations have to be done away with. Neither does the intermittent occurrences of being trapped in mental, mental conflict that you spoke of a moment ago. Nothing has to be done about that. You know, the fact is that we've never been able to do anything about that anyway, so it should be a relief to find that nothing needs to be done about it. All that needs to be done is, and you know, when the mind's all wrapped up in conflict with itself, you won't do this, and that's okay. But at those times when that's not the case, instead of seeking after the peacefulness and the sweetness and so forth, just when it's not the case and when it occurs to you to do so, look to see whether it is not true that you are absolutely certain of only one thing, which is that you are, and that certainty is untouched, unhelped, unenhanced, and undiminished by anything in the mind. And if you will do that without worrying about the expectations that arise from doing it, if you will just do that, over time, I promise you, all these things will be taken care of. Because it is that certainty that is the target of your investigation. That's all there is to it. Just this underlying, unmoving presence that is so, so difficult to see, it seems, but is never absent and never not seen. Just to get that taste, just like we did a moment ago, just every once in a while, that's all that you have to do. You don't need to worry about the way things come and go in the mind. You don't need to worry about the appearance and disappearance of good states or bad states. You really don't need to worry about anything. All that's needed is that as often as you can, you taste that. And even though it will be some time, there will be some time passed during which there will be the continuing entanglement with the shifting states of mind and so forth. If you keep doing this, I promise you that'll all stop. And that in the end, what will the realization will be that you are what you are, and you are untouched and unaffected by any of it. In the end, the result will be the end of this undercurrent of anxiety and fearfulness that you're doing something wrong, that there is something wrong, that I can do better. All of that will go away. Just look at this. Look at this reality as often as you can. Don't concern yourself with the rest of it. Do you hear that?
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Is that helpful, Tal? Do you hear what I'm saying?
Yes, this is very helpful. It's exactly what I needed to hear from you.
Wonderful.
To be more calm.
That's very wonderful. Please keep in touch with me. I know you've written to me before. Please keep in touch with me. I want to hear how you're doing, okay?
Yeah. Thanks a lot, John.
You're very welcome. Anybody else, Carl? One more, maybe?
David Bortman, calling from Ashland, Oregon.
Hi, David. Haven't seen you for a while. I'm very happy that you're here. When I say I haven't seen you for a while, I mean I haven't seen you in physical presence for a while. But I'm glad to see you here. I'm happy to hear from you as we have. And
John, I just wanted to air a couple of things out and see maybe if you have any comments.
Okay.
Life has been not going the way I would like it to go. The real problem, of course, is one of control. It's very clear but difficult to put into words. Things are just, you talk about the metaphor of the lotus eater. And there's a part of me right now that can absolutely relate to that. On the other hand, life moves on and I have children to take care of. And I fundamentally am lost. And I don't trust... again, the problem is control because I feel like I have to steer the ship, and yet there is this feeling that I am definitely, that the ship cannot be steered. So the issue is one of letting go, and I find that as flexible as I would like to believe I am, the conflict comes because I'm really not flexible. And yet, there's always that sense of, I am this, present always. So, the expectation there, too, is that that will bring solace, that will bring comfort, and that the storm can be, I can ride out the storm, and with a sense of peacefulness, a sense of inward calm. But the agitation is right now is so intense in my life because I feel totally on the edge that I see things crumbling, and there's really nothing I can do about it.
Well, I don't think that control's the problem, or letting go is the problem, or rigidity is the problem, or the agitation in your life is the problem. I mean, all of these things may well be operational problems within the personality itself. These may be neurotic tendencies or things of that nature, which are operating within the personality itself. And it may well be that there are things that can be done about the kind of brokenness of the personality, but that's not, and that may or may not be necessary, and it may or may not be needed in the end. But the idea that inquiry, I have to say this, and this might sound kind of unsympathetic or something, but it's not. The idea that the inquiry, that the washing away of the false belief that you are trapped in this life and that there's nothing to you but this life, and that this life is what the circumstances and the vicissitudes of the life are what determine your comfort or peace or anything else, that idea itself is the heart of the matter. And the idea that the inquiry will bring comfort and peace to the life, I think, is a false expectation. And the thing that makes it's okay, false expectations are okay too. All expectations are false. But the thing that makes it pernicious in this particular case is the way in which it tempts us away from the possibility of just looking at yourself every once in a while, because it's not changing anything, because the life is hard and it's getting worse and it's falling to pieces, and I can see where I am trying to control things and failing and all of that, and all of that's going on. But the inquiry, the purpose of the inquiry and the effect of the inquiry, the consequence of the inquiry, is not to bring comfort and peace to the life and to bring clarity and an end to confusion in the mind. The purpose of the inquiry is to wash away the belief that you're trapped in the life. It's not to fix the life. Is to wash away the belief that you're trapped in the life. So the characteristics and the rising and falling of the things that happen in the life are kind of not kind of above my pay grade. What I have to offer is entirely the possibility of despite everything, despite the craziness of the personality, despite the way the life is coming to pieces, despite the fact that, oh God, I don't know, have anything, despite the fact that there's no comfort, despite the fact that there's no peace, the possibility is in the midst of all of that, or in the moments when it occurs to you to do so, that you stop for a second, for no reason whatsoever, and see if you cannot have the direct experience of the certainty being of the spaciousness that you are, of the space in which all of this is happening, not in order to make it go away, but in order to make go away the conviction that you're trapped in this madness. And quite paradoxically and unexpectedly, it's my experience and the experience of many that over time, although it may seem for a time that it even gets worse, it even gets more of a storm raging, that over time, the peace that you seek, the clarity that you seek, the comfort that you seek will reveal itself to have always been here as you, will reveal itself to have always been here, having nothing to do with the agitation of the mind. And it's my experience that as that proceeds, as that washing away of that idea that I'm trapped in this life proceeds, that the mind just kind of begins to calm down, that the movement to control just kind of begins to weaken because it no longer has the energy of the underlying fearfulness and anxiety that comes from this conviction that I'm trapped in the life. But all I can help you with is to bring your attention back again and again without regard to what's happening and what's preventing you from doing so, to show you again and again that none of that prevents you from seeing yourself. None of it. And it's seeing that does the work. It's just seeing. And it's not what you expect. Because in the end, it's all the same. Nothing changes except that which always is changing. You are here. You're never absent. Just look at that from time to time. And I know it's hard. It can be hard because we do things based on the idea that we're going to get some particular benefit from them. But even the idea that, oh, God, it's not helping, it's not doing it, even that can be ignored for a second just to look at yourself, just for one second. You're here. Here. Certainly. You're here. You're not changed. None of that touches you. And if you will look there as often as you can, everything else will be taken care of. Do you hear me?
Absolutely. And I am not under the illusion that the inquiry should make things better, but I honestly, that expectation, the intellectual understanding is very keen, but the emotional buy-in seems, there's an expectation there, and it's haunting.
Yes, but it cannot stop you all the time. It can get in the way sometimes, but it cannot stop you all the time. There will always be times when it's possible for you to stop and look. Do you follow that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, John.
Oh, you're very welcome. Please keep in touch and let me know how you're doing. Do we have one more, Carla? Okay, I think we're going to let that go for now. And let this meeting go for now. I know that for some of you it must be deep in the dark hours of the morning, and for some of you it, God knows when it is, what time it is. I say this all the time. The fact that I say it all the time does not diminish the potency of the realization that comes to me all the time of how absolutely lucky we are and how wondrous it is for us to be able to meet like this. This is fantastic. We are, as I've said before, looking into other technologies that might make it a little less difficult, but I'm so grateful for this technology. I'm so happy to be here. So happy to see you all here, to hear from you, to speak with you. I'm not going to say much except that the aspect that I want to stress, again and again about this practice is that it is practical, and that there have been, throughout the thousands of years, in which the insight that what I've always wanted is to see what's real, over the thousands of years in which that insight has appeared here and there and from place to place, there have been many interpretations that have arisen that seek to convey the flavor of reality, the flavor of the underlying essential taste of it. And the fact that these things are even written or spoken is a little bit strange, really, since all who have written and spoke them know from their own experience that we already, all of us already, forever, are knowing the nature of reality, that it is precisely it's precisely what we see is the nature of reality in its totality, not in, you know, the tight focus on one aspect or another aspect, not the tight focus on the oneness of all, which of course excludes the two-ness of all, not the tight focus on the me and you and what I need and what I need to get from you, but the inclusive, spacious realization, spacious reality that is actually always, always present, always in your awareness, always, in which all things are included, in which everything has as its nature the same essential substance, which is you, which is this spacious, permanent beingness that you are. But when I say that, I'm doing the same thing as everybody else. I am speaking an interpretation of what's real, your spaciousness, your permanence, your whatever. And you are not that. You are bigger than that. You are all that is, inclusive. And even that, as I speak it, is an interpretation, is a story about you, which is not true, and spoken only with the desire to inflame in you, the desire to see yourself. Because I know that it doesn't matter what you think you're going to get. If you actually turn your attention to this underlying reality, it will take care of everything else. Because I know from my own experience that the seeing is all. The neurotic or unneurotic or spiritual or unspiritual reasons that bring us to this conscious seeing are irrelevant. The seeing is all. The practicality is all. The pragmatism of this practice is all. Look at yourself as often as you can. Look at yourself as often as you can. Don't worry about the rest of it. Don't worry about worrying about the rest of it. You are here. You are never absent. So that's pretty much all I have to say. And I, again, thank you. I am really, truly at your service. I am your servant in this. I love to hear from you. I'm looking into a new way of handling emails in the near future, which maybe I can, which maybe will be more useful to you than my previous procrastination. I love you all. I love you all. I am at your service. Please stick around for a little bit. Carla has a couple of things that she needs to tell you about. I'll see you again, and as they say, I'll see you on the radio or on the internet. I'll see you when I see you. I love you forever. Bye.